sound bites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And good afternoon to another edition of Soundbites. We thank you for tuning in. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And yes, Nick is sadly being missed, but no fear, folks. He will be back. We will assure you of that. We've had a number of folks, you know, say, is he ever coming back? Yes, he's on the mend.
Yep.
And it just takes, as we get older, it takes longer to heal.
That's okay.
You just don't bounce back. Take it from me, who's older than dirt anyways. Matter of fact, I keep telling folks I invented dirt. Because it's just the way we are, you know, and I think everybody will realize that. But we've also been passing on the good wishes that he does get back and gets back soon. But until then, we just sort of keep putzing along here.
It's true.
We're here to take your questions. The number here at the station is 966-5299. You can also reach us toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. And if you've got a particular topic that you want us to talk about or discuss of that, hey, you don't always have to have a question, but you might have something else that you might want to know a little bit more about. Please call in and let us know. Meanwhile, one of the things that we're sort of throwing around here is Twitter.
It's true.
Yeah. They all of a sudden just changed their name, and supposedly that's going to be magically changing everything for Mr. Musk.
But apparently he didn't realize that there are literally hundreds of other companies that have a trademark on X for different things, including Microsoft and Facebook.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like...
Well, and in the App Store, Apple has a rule that you can't have an app that has only a single letter. The minimum length for app names is 2 letters. So I'm not sure
what
he's going to do. Yeah, so that's unusual. He has changed the icon, I think, in the App Store, but I don't know.
He should do a double X.
Hey, make it 3.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll help him. I don't think that's going to get the audience.
It can't make it any worse for him, that's for sure.
Well,
sit there and buy a company and you tank it so bad that you've lost half of what you paid for it?
I think he's got a plan. I wish I knew precisely what was going on, but it seems like every other week I'm hearing about a change that sort of comes out of left field. And the next thing that's happening is makes me raise an eyebrow and say, okay, I'm not sure what that's about. It's sort of like one of those weird movies where you don't know. It's like a whodunit. And they keep revealing more and more things that are happening, and you're thinking, oh, well, surely this will all start to make sense soon. And then it never quite does. It's like constant cliffhangers. So this is definitely one of those.
Yeah, it's amazing what he's going to do. Well, a lot of folks are going over to Zuckerberg's Threads.
To Threads, yeah. Now, Threads had a whole bunch of people that, because they brought over the what they call the user graph, that's the... a single user account, and then the relationships it has to others. They call that a graph. They brought over the graph from Instagram. Right? Mm-hmm. So Instagram has people, and lots of people, and lots of who they're related to. And one of the things you get to leverage when you have somebody that joins is you can say, hey, your friend from Instagram just joined Graph. Wouldn't you like to check out and see what they're saying?
Yeah.
Or, you know, this celebrity that you follow on Instagram is over here now. So it makes it a compelling thing. And then the network effect happens. And just like, you know, things that catch fire, you know, they
just keep spreading.
Keep spreading and spreading and spreading. And I think very quickly after it was announced, it got very, very big. But I think it's all going to come down to, are there enough people there that are saying things that you want to be aware of?
Yeah, a lot of it, it's, you know, folks are noticing it's just a lot of rehashing the same old stuff, and it's like, yeah, I don't really want to, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends. Why are you there, right? So mm-hmm. There are some people that are just never going to leave Twitter, either because they don't want to or don't have to, or it's related to their job or they're a journalist or what have you.
Yeah.
Other people who are sort of tech nerds, they're going to jump over to Mastodon or potentially get invites to Blue Sky and try that instead. But it's all kind of getting fragmented, and trying to figure out where everything's going to land is a little tricky. You know, it's one of those things where we had a lot of different chat and microblogging services in the late 2000s, and everything kind of centralized around Twitter. And now that it's becoming much more fragmented again, it is one more thing to try and have to figure out.
Yeah, yeah. All right, tell you what, we already got a caller calling in. Let's talk to Ed from Ithaca. Go ahead, Ed.
Good morning, guys. Thanks again for being there.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I have two questions. One is, I think, pretty brief. The other may or may not be. The briefest one is on battery life.
Mm-hmm.
I know I want to keep it between 40 and 80. That's sort of the sweet zone. But if I keep a computer plugged in, a battery plugged in, and it's always at 100, is that okay? Does that put more stress on the battery than trying to keep it in that zone?
Short answer, yes.
Hmm.
It also depends on the battery's chemistry. Batteries have used different chemicals throughout the years to try and separate anode from cathode and to get electrons to move from one side to the other.
Right.
In ye olden days, there were lead-acid batteries that were in all the luggables from the early 80s.
Oh, this is a MacBook.
Sure. And things have progressed since then, and we've gone to nickel-cadmium and then lithium-ion. The modern batteries, I've seen that the place where I work during the week, we see machines that kind of stay plugged into the wall all week, and we're seeing that, they might not have a lot of cycles on them, you know, a lot of charge-discharge cycles, mm-hmm. but we are seeing that they are just not able to hold the same amount of capacity as they were, which is sort of surprising. Typically, batteries would age based on the number of cycles they've mm-hmm. been exposed to, but being plugged in all the time, in my experience so far, has been detrimental to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Apple does have a page specifically for their own batteries, so a lot can depend on the manufacturer of the battery and the manufacturer of the charger.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple has some smarter battery charging techniques they use with their batteries, where say your phone that you typically plug in to charge overnight, it won't charge fully until your habit of what time you get up in the morning. So say you get up at 8, it won't fully charge until just before 8. So it doesn't put too many charge cycles on it, so it doesn't wear it out faster.
Right.
And there's kind of two ways that batteries wear out. As Dennis says, the charging cycles and just their physical age and holding a charge. When you store a battery, you should store it at about 50% or less, but not much less. You know, don't store it below 10%.
Right.
When you typically with a laptop that doesn't move very often, you would leave it plugged in all the time. Generally speaking, once a month or so, you can drain the battery completely and let it charge completely again to refresh the chemistry. Not refresh. What's the word they use? Recycle. Recalibrate.
Up. There you go.
Because there's actually a little tiny CPU chip in the batteries. And for a while, it was a 65CO2, which was the brain of the original Apple II.
Right.
That was the battery management chip.
Smaller.
Yeah.
What was nice back in the day is when you could take that battery out of a laptop.
That's true.
And just leave it plugged in, set the battery off to the side, so you weren't wearing it out by putting that many cycles.
Yeah.
Right.
But those days have now gone by the wayside, just like taking batteries out of a cell phone. When the cell phones first came out, you could used to have a backup charger. You could have one sitting in the charger while one was in the phone.
Right.
And you could constantly switch batteries, but you can't do that anymore.
And Apple does have a setting in your settings app to optimize the battery charging and charge limit for iOS 13 and later and macOS Big Sur and later. So that helps keep the battery chemistry from aging prematurely and also from running out of charging cycles.
Right. One of the other factors is that do you have many people have other things plugged into their laptops or their other devices. You know, if you've got your phone while you're out on the train or wherever, you're charging your phone or connecting your phone to your laptop, and right. It's literally taking some electrons from the battery inside the laptop and transferring them dutifully through the cable back over to the mm-hmm. to the phone, and that can drain your laptop battery faster than normal. So there are lots of factors involved, but in general, I would say having it connected all the time to the wall is probably not ideal.
Okay.
And Apple limits charging to 80% when it doesn't need to be charged fully. So
right.
it recognizes your patterns. The other issue is heat.
Mm-hmm. Batteries hate heat.
Right. We had a couple come into our store this morning, and both of their iPhones that were saying had short battery life. We ran diagnostics on it, and the batteries passed all the testing. And looking at the battery log on how much energy was being used by certain apps, we could tell that it's very hot and it's draining faster because of it. In fact, especially on a cell phone, if you leave your cell phone in the car, I've even had it where I set it on the dash when I'm using it as the GPS, you can get the overheating warning and the phone
sure.
will shut down basically mm-hmm. until it cools off.
Yep.
So the ambient range of temperatures is 62 to 72 is the ideal for your for
right.
your battery.
Yeah. Yeah, really
don't
wants to be in a cool room.
Yeah, don't let it exceed 95 Fahrenheit.
Okay, that's getting harder and harder.
Yeah.
That's the truth.
Yeah. Okay.
But great. I've posted the link from Apple website, and there's a lot of general battery information too. Lithium ion batteries are very common across the spectrum of devices now.
Right.
And there's a lot of general information there in addition to specific Apple settings that you can make.
Right. Okay. Good. So my second question is I have an older brother printer, an MFC 7860, which I just got given to me. It has wireless capacity, but I don't know how to set that up with my computer.
Right. Let's see. So the MFC series, I think, is a multifunction copier.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Many of them have a screen on the front where yeah. you can go through the wireless setup wizard.
Oh.
The printers that don't have a screen, generally you need to download the setup program from the manufacturer,
mm-hmm. yeah.
plug it USB into your computer to set it up to your Wi-Fi.
Right.
But if you're lucky enough to have a screen, and even if you do have a screen, typing in your Wi-Fi password
yeah.
can be annoying.
Oh.
So quite often you can download the, in your case, the Brother wireless setup. Go to the Brother page for that specific model printer
right?
And download the, sometimes they call it wireless setup or network setup, so that you can join your network and type in your Wi-Fi password.
Uh-huh. Okay.
One of the factors that comes into play when you're dealing with wireless printing is that sometimes the printers, especially if they might be slightly older, only know how to communicate. They only have the antennas for older Wi-Fi frequencies.
2.4 gigahertz versus the 5 gigahertz.
Right. And one of the things that can be a challenge is if your router has those antennas, that's great. If it doesn't, you're going to run into a problem that the printer is never going to feel like it connects to the network, no matter how much you tell it about it.
Yeah.
But it's important to keep that in mind. I've also seen on a Brother printer that I had in the past, that the printer would fall into a deep sleep mode, and just simply getting information from across the wireless network wasn't
yeah.
always enough to wake it up.
You'd have to actually hit a button on it to wake it up.
Which was annoying, because then you'd have to get up out of your chair, walk over to the printer.
Go to the other side
yep.
of the room.
Grumble all the way over.
Yeah.
Stab the button with your finger, and then wait for it to wake up, and then wait for it and be annoyed at it, and tap your foot while you're waiting for it to wake up, and then the print to finally come out.
One of the things we've seen in the Eero routers that we sell is there's a troubleshooting section in the Eero app where you can turn off 5 gigahertz temporarily.
Yeah.
And that will allow a 2.4 only device to join the network. And then it turns itself back on.
We
so 2.4 gigahertz is
it's the older
standard. It's often called the junk band. Everybody uses 2.4 gigahertz, so it's very crowded. So the five gigahertz band and now the 6 gigahertz band is coming online. Is less crowded, but doesn't go through walls as well.
Right.
The lower the frequency, the better it goes through walls. So if you have a lot of walls in your house, 2.4 might be better. But if you have a lot of devices in your house, 2.4 might not be good, and it'll switch to 5.
Right.
Most modern devices will automatically switch to the best signal they can find.
But yeah, check in with Brother, check the manual. Chances are good that it's probably still in the 2.4 gigahertz range. So just that's something to keep in mind.
Yep.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate your help and being there.
No problem. If you have any other questions or if things go really well and you want to call back and brag about it, be sure and call us back.
Okay. Thanks. Yep. Bye.
Yeah, some of the printers will have a multi-line, multi-function screen where you can do things really easily. I've seen a couple of printers have just a one-line screen.
Yeah.
And that's really tricky to type
Please
in
Please enter your password. Here's the first character, A. Tap the button, B.
Yeah.
Tap the button, C.
So if the first letter in your password is say, a T, you've got to hit
all those other letters.
Right, to get down to the T's.
Roll through to the T.
Then go all the way back up to an A.
Yep.
And if you've got upper and lowercase, that can be its own challenge. So, yeah, if you're getting paid by the hour, do it that way. If you're getting paid by the job, go get the utility, plug it in with USB, get it all set up, and then let it rip. Wireless printing is one of the most common requests that I've had from consulting clients for years. Everybody gets really excited when they don't have to get up out of the lounger and they hear the printer kick on from the other room. They think, oh, I'm living in the future now. This is fantastic.
And companies have tried to make setting up wireless printers easier. Lately, they require you to download an app for iOS or Android and then scan a barcode or QR code on the printer.
Yes.
So then it reads your Wi-Fi settings from your phone and can put them into the printer.
Right. That way you never have to type it in. You never have to remember which network am I connected to.
Yep.
It kind of just inherits the settings that came from the phone.
There's a new unsettling trend in some printers, especially we've seen from HP. If they have an E in their name, that's might be one to look out for. So C is color, D is duplex,
N is network,
W is wireless,
right? T is extra printer tray.
Extra tray. Yep. E is eek. So many times the printers require an internet connection to the printer. Even if you're only going to print USB, it requires a full-time internet connection.
What do they want that for?
They want that so they can monitor your ink status because you're required to subscribe to monthly or six-monthly ink tank purchases.
Yuck.
Oh, hell no.
Which, if you print a lot, it's kind of nice.
It could be convenient.
Right. It knows you're going to run out of ink, so it just shows up in the mail.
Right.
But that's very, very annoying. And the fact that a lot of people don't necessarily need the printer on the network. They just want to plug up Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And that's how we found out about this. A customer lived very rurally, and her only internet was cellular hotspot from her phone.
Uh-huh.
So she rarely got on the internet on her computer. And her printer stopped working after 5 or 10 pages and printed out this thing that said, connect to the internet. No.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yikes. All right, let's go back to the phones. We got Vivian from Honeyoy. Go ahead, Vivian.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have received an email from Google that says, Dear customer, your Google storage is full. And I usually am on DuckDuckGo. I use Macs. And so I went to it and it said, I can get 50 gigabytes for free, if I, give them my information, So I went online, but one of the things that they wanted was a credit card number. So I didn't know if this was legit or not.
Well, maybe. So Google does offer additional cloud storage.
That's true.
If you're using Google Cloud. So that's the first thing. Do you have like Google Drive or Google Photos that you're using Google Cloud services?
I'm not anymore, really.
Okay. So it may still be running unless you specifically turned it off. in your computer.
I didn't turn it off, no.
So it could be a legitimate message, but there's a lot of fake messages like this too.
Yeah.
So you want to log into your Google account directly, one.one.google.com, and it will tell you how much disk space you're using. You get 15 gigs free, and you can buy more. And it will tell you what's using the space, Google Drive, Google Mail, or Google Photos.
Okay.
So you can decide to stop using the service that's using the space, or you can choose to buy more storage. They do need to have a credit card so they can charge you for more storage.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But don't click the link in the email. You want to go to the Google website yourself.
Right.
Right. Okay. Directly, because I thought, well, if they're giving me this for free, why do they want my credit card number?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So
you can get 100 gigs of more storage for $1.99 a month.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
You had another question?
Right. Yes, I did. When I went into the Google account, I don't have the – it's told me to turn on safe browsing in Google, which I hadn't had. Should I do that?
Safe browsing is a feature that Google makes available, and it filters the results that you get when you use their services to perform a web search. If there is a certain kind of content that you might find objectionable, then this could be a – or if you have children or other people making use of your computer and you'd like to restrict the type of results that they see – then that could be a tool that would be useful to you.
Typically, it's adult material that it blocks from showing up in your search.
That's not an issue for me in my house here.
All right. Well, and then that may not be necessary. Also, if you're using DuckDuckGo as a browser, it sounds like you're somebody who's privacy concerned. DuckDuckGo, for our listeners, is a browser that actively tries not to store information or collect information about what people do with the browser. And in that case, I think that there's no huge reason to turn on these services, particularly if you're using DuckDuckGo's search engine and not Google's anyway.
Right. Right.
And DuckDuckGo recently released their own web browser that they wrote themselves with privacy in mind rather than using Chrome or Safari or Edge or one of the other browsers. So they have their own browser now, too.
Right. Okay. That's very helpful. And one other question that I have, I used to be able to go to something online here through Soundbites that listed different things that I could go to find out information to better use my computer, and I can't, and I lost the paperwork for it, and I don't remember what the address is.
Hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Not off the top of my head.
We have links to websites that we talk about on the show. There's the Security Tango for running.
That's it, the Security Tango.
Yeah, that's for running anti-malware and antivirus programs.
Right.
That has fallen off our front page after the web redesign, and as soon as Nick is up and around again, he's going to add it back.
Right.
But it's securitytango.com is that website.
That's right.
So I'd still be able to get to it and get the information that I want.
Yep.
I've kind of fallen by the wayside of being really good about security, and this is not the time to do that, I know.
Yeah.
securitytango.com is the place to go, and you'll be able to see everything you're looking for there.
Thank you very much for all your help, and you have a good day.
You too, Vivian. Thank you for calling.
Okay.
All right, that music tells me we got to take a short break, but hey, don't go too far. We will be back in just a few moments with more sound bites here at Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More sound bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And welcome back to this edition of Soundbites. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And tell you what, we'll go right to the phones. We got Larry from Fairport who's been patiently waiting. Go ahead, Larry.
Yes, I have a question about Microsoft Word spell checker.
Okay.
I have an older version. I think it's a 2013 version of Microsoft Word. I wrote a nice document up and wanted to check the spelling, and I went to the review pull down tab, hit the review pull down tab, a little window comes up and says spell check is complete, and there was no mistakes, which I know is not true at all. I'm a horrible speller. So I tried numerous times, looked at different menu options about spell checker, and it never seemed to come up and give, the underline when you spell a word wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I then transferred to, I sent it via email to another machine, to another person, and she went through it, and it did the same thing. It did not show all the mistakes. So is there a setting or something that I'm missing, or what could possibly be going wrong here?
Yeah. Is this Word 2013 for Windows?
Yes.
Okay. So I think there are two different methods by which you can check the spelling. In early, and I'm talking like 1990s, back in the 1900s versions of Word, spell check was a function that you would start, and then it would take a look at the document, and it would roll through each word and compare it against its internal dictionary, and then let you know if there was something that showed up that wasn't in the dictionary the way they was expecting to see it. As time went on, Microsoft created a secondary feature called auto-check, or check spelling as you type, I think was the phrase that they look for. And I think that's a tool that could be helpful for you. In Microsoft Word 2013, the instructions that I found online quickly while I was listening to your question were, once you have Word open, going to the File menu and choosing Options, and then Proofing, and then there's a checkbox for Enable Check Spelling as You Type. And then when you click OK, what should happen after that, once you have your document open, is any word that Microsoft thinks is not matching its internal dictionary, whether it's a misspelling or whether you're just using a very esoteric and unique word, should receive a little red squiggle under it.
Okay.
That's what we expect the behavior to be.
Okay.
Well, one of the problems I'm finding is that since 2013 has been unsupported, they removed a lot of the information from their website. So I got to go to third-party websites.
Believe it or not, we do research these things in real time.
Yeah. Do you have the ribbon or button bar at the top? I forget when they added that.
I'm really not sure what that is.
A whole bunch of extra buttons under the menu.
Quick question for you, though. Do you have a Chrome account?
No.
You don't use Google Chrome?
Yeah. Oh, wait. They do have
a Chrome. Yeah. You could use a different word processor. That's
another
choice. Yeah,
I mean, you could always try reading, because Chrome, you can go into Google Docs, pull the document in there, and see if it'll spell check it there.
Okay.
Yeah. In Word 2013, there is a spelling and grammar window that should come up when you hit F7.
Right.
And that is the window I think you're looking for that goes through word by word and stops on the misspelled words. And it's in the review button in the in the button bar.
Right.
It's also possible that your misspelled words are also legitimate words.
Right.
I do that all the time.
Yeah.
I get from and form backwards all the time.
Oh, sure. And they're both words.
They're both words.
Word
they're both spelled right. Yep.
Necessarily what you meant.
Nothing wrong with them.
In fact, that happened in the cider mailing that we had our annual picnic, and it said bring your swimsuits because of the pool, except I forgot the L.
Okay.
There's a heated pool. Without an L?
Yikes. I'm going to leave my swimsuit at home.
But my spell checker didn't stop because that was a word.
Well, it makes for a good story anyway.
Yeah.
It just shows me how much we've come to depend on software to help us on stuff, because just about helpless. I would love to go and get into a time transporter and go back to when I graduated from college, and I won't tell you when. With a copy of Microsoft Word, I wouldn't have needed to. I could have spent a lot less time on doing lab reports.
For sure.
And we were a lot more careful about our typing, because a lot of professors didn't like whiteout.
Oh,
yeah. So
if you're old enough to remember what whiteout is,
yes.
you could white out your mistake and type over top of it. So if you made a mistake, you had to retype the whole page.
For those right. kids out there, it's like nail polish, but white.
Right.
Yeah, paint, it's white paint. You put on a misspelled word on your typewriter.
Yeah.
So that you could type over top of it.
And it was invented by Mike Nesmith's mom.
Yeah, from the Monkees. Right.
And the lab reports, too, had a lot less content than what students are doing today.
Yeah.
With all the things that they can research. So
yeah.
But and then on the other side, I've read stories about younger kids in school, mm-hmm. and, you know, looking at a piece of paper and say, why isn't the red underline showing up?
Well,
that's a piece of paper. That's mm-hmm. not a computer.
Yeah, I got some bad news. That's not e-ink.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still have checks in my checkbook. How could I be out of money?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, guys. I'll try a few of those different things. Yep. And you're saying the F7 key under the review tab.
Yep. Well, the review tab should have the spelling option, and F7 should bring that up. No matter what tab you're in,
right.
One of the other things that it might be is if the spelling and grammar tools got accidentally removed or corrupted, you might need to reinstall or run the repair. You run the Office 2013 installer, and there's an option to repair the install, and it may reload those dictionaries for you.
Okay. Maybe that's what I need to be doing too. So that's under, and that would be under the installer for Office.
Right. Yeah, okay. unless you bought Word separately, which you used to be able to do. You could buy the mm-hmm. you could buy the three programs separately for a couple hundred apiece, or you buy the whole package for $500.
Right.
Now it's $150 for the whole package.
Yeah, $150 every year, right?
No, $150 once. Per computer.
Per computer.
They okay. So if you only have one computer, that's fine. They do have a $99 subscription for six computers, which is great for a family. But it's $100 a year, and you can put it on actually six computers, six tablets, and six phones.
Right.
Yeah. And Google Docs is free.
And Google Docs is free. And compatible with Microsoft Office files.
And it'll also spit out PDFs if you need be.
Yep.
Nice.
Lots of options out there.
All right. Thank you guys very much.
Yep. Right.
Take care.
Thanks, Larry. Yeah, it's tricky. I can remember using ClarisWorks in college.
Yep.
And I absolutely loved it because it launched fast. It got great at doing what it was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
I had memorized and had muscle memory for all of the keyboard shortcuts for making things bold and aligning them to the left and right. And I knew how to mess with the margins and the font size. And
Apple Works before that.
Sure.
And then Apple Works again after that.
After
they
that.
Kept renaming
right.
it. Yep. I still remember, I don't know why, but FrameMaker that we ran on our Sun workstations.
Right.
Very, very early page layout program. Escape J, Shift P made a new page.
Okay.
Because this was before GUIs and before mice.
I can remember, I think the first word processor I ever used back when I only barely understood what was happening, it was just a typewriter connected to the TV, as far as I knew at the time, was Bank Street Writer on the Apple II. And I can remember having to turn on blocks, having to turn on bold. Okay, now type what you want. Okay, now turn off the bold.
Yeah.
And it was a lot like, 20 years later when I started learning HTML, it was very, very similar. It's like, oh, yes, my brain recalls this. This feels familiar.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We got Don from Pittsburgh on the line. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, hello. What do you know about a program or download called OneLaunch? I encountered this in trying to download a PDF for some printable calendars, monthly calendars. It was installed on my computer, put in a whole new tray line of items, and since then my PC has failed to communicate with my Epson printer. I uninstalled, using install uninstall on Windows 10, the OneLaunch program, and the problem continues.
Right.
It probably left something else behind.
It's a, yeah, it's a tool that is technically legitimate in that it is very honest about the nasty things it's going to attempt to do.
It's not malicious, it's just crap.
Yeah. Bloatware.
And it snuck in from some other installer that you didn't uncheck a box for.
But Revo uninstaller would be our recommendation about what to try.
Get rid of it.
In the research that I've done during this call, I've been able to find a couple of examples where people have said that that's a tool that will remove it without issue.
And because Revo will also look for remnants of other programs that were left behind, because Windows does, how should I put it, a crappy job of uninstalling stuff.
But now that I have uninstalled it, and I go to Revo, and please tell me how to do that. How do I find the remnants of one launch?
Revo will find it for you. It's best at is finding things that didn't uninstall properly. And then next time when you want to uninstall something completely, Revo can do it. Right to begin
along with. Along the left-hand side, there's a menu bar there.
Well, you go to RevoUninstaller.com,
yep.
And you can download the program there.
Is Revo spelled R-E-V-O?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, okay. And they're doing a two-year for the price of one-year bundle if you want, for the pay version.
Matter of fact,
have a free version you can start with.
Right.
Yeah, I wound up getting the USB version. Which, you know, again...
then you can walk around with it?
Just put it on a USB stick, and I can plug it into any computer. It's the updated version, so I only have to buy it once, but I can run it on multiple computers.
Nice.
It also looks like there is something else called OneLaunch, which was a Chromium fork browser claiming to be better, but it's even more and more ads.
Right, and that's essentially what's happening. Is this tool is installing a piece of software into your browser as an extension, and its job is, number one, to keep track of all the different websites you've been to and phone home to its parent company and report about it. And secondarily, its job is to make sure that it shows you or injects ads onto the pages that you are, because that's the way that company makes money.
Would you say that it could be the reason for the failure of communication with my printer?
Hard to say. I doubt it. I think that might be a separate problem. What do you think, Steve?
I say it may have installed some crappy DLL that messed up the printer driver.
Maybe.
Okay, so you say RevoUninstall.com will find it. Will that program also find other programs which should be fully uninstalled?
Yeah, will give you a list of the programs you have with the option to uninstall them, and the programs it found that were partially uninstalled with the option to uninstall them the rest of the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So a lot of times people read something neat on the web and, oh, that's cool, download, install, and then use it for a week and then
forget about it.
And then same thing happens again and again and again over time. Suddenly you've got dozens of programs running back there that you have forgotten about. And so Revo Uninstaller is good at removing all that stuff too.
Okay, you mentioned a little earlier that there were several programs that you found uninstaller that specifically would work on this one launch, or should I just simply concentrate on Revo?
That's our weapon of choice for this particular scenario.
I'm also seeing that some of the anti-malware programs, like Super Anti-Spyware and Malware Bytes, can find and remove it too.
Sure.
Okay, I do have Malware Bytes that I've recently put on the computer.
I'm guessing that would likely serve the same purpose for this particular piece of junkware.
Okay, gentlemen, once again, thank you very much for your good information. I appreciate it.
No problem. Give it a shot. If it works out really well, call us and let us know. If you still have trouble, call us back and let us know that too.
Thank you very much.
Anytime. That's what we do here. We should probably mention that we are streaming live on several different forums. Steve, how many different places can people find us?
Yeah, we're on YouTube, we're on Facebook, and we are on Twitch, although we're getting a big purple error light. I think our internet went down.
Well, we'll figure that out.
Yeah.
I just texted Rob on the radio. I just got an that caller was just saying the same thing. The internet went down.
Okay.
And I texted Rob to let him know even Smooth Jazz went down.
Oh,
so.
No.
Well, because that's the internet streaming station.
Well, it's the kind of thing where, you know, it's time to, if you're one of our lucky radio folks, now is the best time to call because everybody else can't hear that our number is 585-966-JAZZ. That's 585-966-5299. Or that you can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-790-0415.
No, I don't do it there. So I'm trying to join my phone hotspot.
Yeah.
But when the cell phone's too close to the computer, it gives audio feedback.
Yeah. When you're in a room full of microphones that are sensitive to that sort of thing.
Yeah. All right. Now I'm on my cell phone hotspot.
It'll be fine.
If it'll come back again.
Chances are good. We'll find a way to tether this. You know, I'm having similar issues at home with my home internet, and I know I've been talking about this. So gather around, folks, for today is the latest installment of Dennis's computer woes at home. And you'd think that, no, you're Dennis, you're a computer guy. What do you mean? Everything runs perfectly smoothly at your house. Dear listener, I am here to tell you this is not the case.
It's worse when when we can't figure out our own problems.
Right. Or
what is it? The cobbler's children have no shoes.
Yeah. Well, yes. The computer guy's children had no Wi-Fi yesterday, and they were very vocal about that situation. So I came home from work and heard the latest reports and proceeded to run through the standard procedure, which is to go find my cable modem from my local internet service provider and to turn it off and turn it back on and to do the same to my router. And it would proceed to work technically work for a couple of hours. But instead of the multi-hundred megabits I was expecting, I was getting in the tens of megabits. So it was enough to, you know, send emails in and out. And as long as nobody wanted to stream anything or do anything in real time, and definitely no video, it was okay. If you wanted to send a text message through Apple's Messages app, yeah, that would work. But in general, anything that was real time was bad news. So I'm happy to report that I've made contact with the folks. And even after the previous chapter of having to replace the cable modem, which did nothing substantial to help, I do have representatives that will visit me later today and help me discover what they believe the root cause to be. And I'll come back next week and fill you into the next chapter.
All right, let's.
I'm going to go with squirrels.
Yeah, are you putting your money on squirrels? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and we got Ron from Greece on. Go ahead, Brad.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a track phone, a Rebel,
okay.
LG Rebel 4 Lite.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you the model number or whatever. And it keeps saying I don't have a SIM card installed. When I just ended up talking, it'll just drop the internet and drop. It does this all the time. Is that a network issue or a phone issue?
Good question. It depends. It's the best answer. That company has been around for a while, TracFone, and they've been using different networks depending upon which area you're in. Sometimes they'll take wholesale bandwidth from carriers like Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile. And I don't know if you know which carrier TracFone is using.
They're using Verizon. They were bought by Verizon.
Okay. All right, so if they're using Verizon in your area, I'm going back a number of years, Steve, but Verizon didn't use SIMs. They had CDMA technology that was all in the phone. Mm-hmm. But these days, it probably varies depending on the phone. And one of the things that complicates this is that there's the opportunity for modern phones to also have something called an eSIM.
Yeah, we're moving away from physical SIMs
right.
back into built into the phone again.
Right. So I don't, unfortunately, at the moment at the studio presently, have any internet to look this up directly. But the answer, unfortunately, is it could be legitimate.
Yeah.
But it's difficult for me to know.
The internet might be back up.
It's possible. Well, I want to say it's likely a hardware issue. It could be the SIM card. It could be the SIM slot in the phone. Have you tried removing and reinserting the SIM card?
No, I haven't gotten that far yet.
Okay.
But I have another one. I have another LG just like it. So I'm just thinking, and the screen is broken on the one I'm talking on. So I'm thinking about just switching it over to the other one.
Right.
I mean, I bought them at the same time.
Does it say no SIM card emergency calls only?
Yes.
Okay.
Or sometimes it says for your security, and then other times it says there's no network available. But mostly it says for your security or no SIM, and just drops me.
Strange. That smells like something on the phone.
Sometimes I have internet. Sometimes I have internet and I cannot call.
Uh-huh.
It's very unreliable.
Yeah, it's to me. It would seem that the type of thing, knowing about the systems in the phone and the type of error you're receiving, it feels like it could be related to one of the radios in the phone. But again, I would defer to TracFone support and what they. They're more likely to know about the issues of the products they sell than I am.
They're not very good. Their customer service isn't that good.
Yeah, I have been a customer of theirs in the past. I've found that asking to escalate the issue will often produce folks who are better able to communicate and also better able to understand the details of the issues I was presenting to them.
You're right. I've done that. You're right. Now I have another question, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I put Yahoo Mail on this phone, but I also had Gmail on this phone.
Okay.
But the Gmail never worked. So I would delete the Gmail because I don't have a lot of space on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my photos are connected to my Gmail account, but I can't get into my Gmail account. And you don't call Google.
Right. So what I would do is if you have a computer available to you, I would log into your Gmail account and then go into photos.google.com and see if the photos that you care about appear there. Or if they don't, then they're likely on the phone itself.
It doesn't like my password. I mean, can you reset the password for Gmail?
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a forgot password link. Under the login screen when you're logging into Gmail. One of the things it asks you is the last password you remember.
Right.
Right.
And then
right.
It will typically send a code to the cell phone you have on file. So,
okay.
And that's very common for most services and most accounts is that right. They'll text a phone number. So it's very, very important these days to keep your phone number up to date with all your services.
True.
And we've started seeing Google and Apple and some of the big companies every month or so, they'll pop up a message saying, is this still your phone number? Because it's a horrible pain if you change your phone number and they're trying to text a phone you don't have anymore.
So can I still do the forgot password even if I haven't used Gmail in a while? Because I would put it in my phone, then it wouldn't work. I'd delete it. I'm talking like a year. I haven't, because it wasn't working properly. I
right.
was not getting my mail, so I just.
I think doing it from a computer web browser rather than right. from the phone, I think will make that process a bit smoother. And like Steve said, it may send a text message over to your phone. But in general, I think you're going to be okay.
And I don't think Google ever deletes an abandoned account. It just exists there, never used,
right.
filling up with spam.
But I think you'll be all right.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen.
All right.
All right, that music tells me 1 hour has
yeah.
just flown by here, folks. But hey, don't worry. We will be back with another full hour of sound bites to take your computer questions. And if you've got certain topics, again, you want us to talk about, give us a call, 966-5299, toll free 1-800-790-0415. And we will be back in just a few minutes with more sound bites here on Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece, Rochester.
A public service of the Greece Central School District.
Jazz 90.1.
On Facebook at Jazz 901 FM.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And if some folks forgot how it sounded,
yeah. Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday,
July 29th, Anno Domini 2023.
And you, you lucky people, you're listening to Sound Bites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
Steve Ray, I'm tennis for sure. He's David. Okay. Yeah.
I just had to play that one more time. Brings back memories, you know, seeing him sit there screaming it out and pegging the needle.
Every time. You can count on it.
Oh, guaranteed.
And for our streaming listeners and watchers, because of the internet connection we had, I had to create new streams.
Okay.
So you'll have to close your current Facebook and or YouTube stream and make a new one.
Okay. They can do that. We've got very smart listeners. They can do this.
Yep.
I believe in them.
All right. One topic I wanted to get on, as a matter of fact, I had a couple folks asking me.
Go ahead, sir.
As folks know, I'm into ham radio. And a lot of folks, especially older folks now, are going into situations where they're going to into HOAs or maybe into condominiums and everything else.
There might be rules.
And they don't like to have antennas out.
Okay.
Well, a simple solution, which you've heard us talk about before, is called a Raspberry Pi. And you can set up a Raspberry Pi to sit there and connect to your internet connection and with your ham radio join various groups.
Okay.
Over the internet, whether you're using all some of the terms, and some folks that are already familiar with ham radio would know this, is like DMR, YSF, WiresX, D-Star. And they're all internet groups that talk over the internet about ham radio, and they're using ham radios to do this.
So you connect your ham radio to the Raspberry Pi?
So what you what you're doing is you set up this Raspberry Pi to run this dashboard, and you can put various groups in there.
Okay.
And on the radio, you can switch to different groups, key it up, and be part of that conversation. And you can jump on a lot of these radios. You can get them relatively inexpensive. I mean, there's some Bofangs. They're a Chinese radio that you can get for like $50-$60. And you're not required to have a big antenna. You just literally need this Raspberry Pi hotspot set up because it's got what they call a little MMDVM hat. And it's got a little antenna which talks to your internet.
Okay, so let me be sure I've got this right. So you buy the Raspberry Pi. The Raspberry Pi is a single board computer about the size of a credit card.
Yep.
You plug that into the wall for power. And you can connect it either to your Wi-Fi or to your wired internet.
Yep.
And it has a set of pins on it. So then you buy something that goes on top called a hat.
Yep.
And the hat stands, I think, for hardware on top or something like
that. Yeah, what they call
hardware accessory.
MMDVM. It's a multi-mode modem.
And you can think of that like an expansion card for your computer.
You think about it as the old days, like when you wanted to connect to the internet, you had to buy this modem.
Right.
And you had to put your phone into it, a coupler, or just a box that you had to run a cable to in your phone line. And you used to have to, on your computer, dial it up, and it would go, you know, making all the sounds.
The and sound finally of its people.
Yeah, and connect, and then you could get on the internet.
Uh-huh.
Well, this Raspberry Pi does the same thing.
Okay.
It winds up connecting to the internet. And then you can go to the various services like Brandmeister and all these others that host these talk groups.
Hmm.
And people can talk worldwide. And you can find a multitude of topics that you have various interests, whether it's, say, camping or hiking, you name it. It's out there, and there are talk groups. And it's great for folks that maybe can't get out as much. And just want to talk to other folks about their hobbies, whether it's coin collection or whatever. They're all out there, and they're a great group of folks. And like I said, you don't have to have the big antenna, which is going to get you in trouble with your HOA.
Sure.
Because, you know, they don't want that obscure thing sitting up in the lawn.
I've read some horrible HOA stories.
No, yeah.
Especially if your house is next to an HOA, but you're not part of it, and they claim you are.
Yeah. And so this way, you know, you can get on there, have some fun, relatively inexpensive, and not be an annoyance.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a number of folks. As a matter of fact, I was just setting up, telling Steve, excuse me, I just set up another one for this other service because there's a few folks that I was showing this to, which go, oh, great. You know, I can get out and talk to various groups that they have interest in.
Right.
And they heard it while I was, I happened to be up at Seabreeze.
Okay.
Doing an activation up there, and we got talking, and I had the handheld there, and you could hear the groups talking there, and they're going, where's that coming from? I says, it's just tethered to my phone, and this handheld's talking to that.
Hmm.
And I didn't have to have the big antenna, just this little thing, like you say, which is no bigger than a bar of soap.
Right.
With a little antenna on it, and as long as it's tethered, it's got wireless internet connection. Again, the world's wide open in as many... I mean, you can literally put thousands of different rooms. The radio will, the handheld will hold it, and right. You can program into it.
Amazing.
Through what they call a code plug.
So what's the standard for people who have heard about ham radio for a long time but are interested? You know, what's the minimum buy-in to get into this, and what should they expect to do? I know in the past you had to have a license from
you
the FCC.
Still do. You still do.
In the past, I know you had to learn Morse code to pass the exam.
That rule they've done away with.
Okay, so that's no longer a requirement.
Right. And there is a group here in Rochester called RARA.
Okay, what do they do?
Rochester Area Radio Association. And we are a group of hams. It's one of the longest-running ham radio clubs in the U.S.
Okay.
I think there's only one other that's older than us or very close to it. And we meet once a month, but we also offer for folks that want to get into ham radio free exam classes. All you got to do is get the book, study. There's three classes of license. There's the technician.
Okay.
Which gives you, if you look at the bands, you're allowed so much latitude is what you can talk on. So if you go to general, it opens it up a little more. If you go for your extra, it's wide open for the whole band. And most folks wind up taking, I've seen it many a time where folks will come in, they sit for the technician, they do pretty darn good after they're studying, and they quick take the general the same time. They walked in with nothing and came out with the general license, which gives them a broad spectrum that they can now talk to people all over the world on these handhelds.
So when you take these exams, what kinds of things are they covering? What kinds of power ratings you're allowed to broadcast
safety,
with?
Safety, yeah, and just basic electronics.
Okay.
You know, and they're getting big into the digital modes now.
Okay.
Because I do a lot of contacts in that through what they call FT8. It's a digital mode, just connecting to folks all over the world. I've got my one room is just plastered from the ceiling down the floor with QSL cards that I've collected throughout the year.
So a QSL card is when you have a successful connection to someone else, they put a postcard in the mail and mail it to you?
I send them one and they turn around and send one back to
me. So it's sort of like being a pen pal, but without the pen.
Yeah, exactly.
And what I always find interesting is there have been... Well, in the airplane... RC airplane world that I'm part of, the FAA is starting to require taking tests and licensing and registration, and all the old timers are up in arms. But that's so very common for everything else,
right?
Yeah.
Ham radio, you're using the public airwaves.
Sure,
you can't legally do it without a license,
right?
In the same way, you can't drive on public roads
without a license.
Without a license, and your car has to be registered.
One of the things that they're adding in the airplane world is remote ID, which is basically like a license plate for your airplane.
So that's like a beacon, or how does it work?
Yeah, it's a radio transmitter that you have to put in your plane, and anyone with the problem is anyone with the right app can pick up that signal,
right,
and find the owner of that. Airplane.
So they they get the
GPS coordinates, basically.
They get GPS, or do they get just the call letters, or how does
GPS coordinates?
Okay.
And so it's very similar to a license plate on your car. And the intent is when something goes wrong, they're able to track down the pilot.
Yeah.
Just you know, in your car, something goes wrong in the car, your license plate lets you track down the owner. So I can see the privacy implications of it. But the reason that this is being pushed is Homeland Security has talked a lot about it. A lot of law enforcement agencies have talked about it.
Right.
People are buying cheap quadcopters,
sure.
And drone. You know, using the word drone, which we we hate. They're buying a cheap drone at a box store and crashing it into their neighbor's house and causing problems.
Mm-hmm.
And just like every type of industry, the bad guys aren't going to follow the rules.
Oh no!
So all of these rules are just putting the onus on regular people,
right,
to get these licenses and to get registered. In the early FAA bill, you had to get a separate remote ID module for every airplane you owned.
Oh, well, hobbyists might have way more than one.
Yeah, I have 20 or 30 now.
Like if I had to get a license plate for every bicycle I own,
right?
Be in line for a while.
But on the other side, you have to get a license plate for every car you own.
True.
But you're...
When I run into people with my car, bad things happen. When I run into people with my bike, not as much.
And having more than two or three cars is very unusual.
True.
Having 30 or 40 airplanes over a 50-100 year career of model airplanes is very common.
Yeah.
Right.
So they changed that so you'll be able to move your remote ID module from plane to plane to plane.
Which makes sense.
Or if you fly at a organized club field,
okay,
you won't need remote ID at all. Although supposedly this takes place in September and
TikTok, right?
The FAA hasn't really
done
much yet.
Right.
But so people that don't live near an officially recognized club, just flying in your backyard is technically going to now you're supposed to have a license if your aircraft is more than 250 grams.
Right.
So the little toys you buy are
probably okay.
Exempt.
Right.
The big problem has actually been the success of DJI. And the commercial drones you see.
So those are that's a company that's well known for producing high quality units. A little bit more expensive than the typical toys.
Right.
Yeah.
But
very good.
Quite often they have very easy to use controls where you have a map and you say fly from here to there. And it does. So it's the autonomous part of it that's a problem. With regular hobby aircraft, you gotta learn how to fly it.
Yeah. No, you're remotely controlling, mm-hmm, quite literally, the servos that hit the throttle and control all the control surfaces.
And the same thing.
Good landings.
Yeah, same thing in the rocket community I'm in. You have to take a test to prove that you know how to build and fly,
mm-hmm,
safely. The ham, you have to take a test to know you can follow the rules safely.
Right.
Yep.
Even here in the radio business, we often have to take a test to prove that we know how to operate safely and not do things that
run afoul of the rules.
The FCC just came down on one guy out in California.
Okay.
He bought one of these cheap Chinese radios that weren't allowed here in the U.S.
Okay.
And, they were having the wildfires.
Oh.
And he started getting on there. He dialed into the fire channel and was going across the air.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept telling him, get off this channel. Get off this channel. They finally hunted him down, and he is now facing a $25,000 fine and suspension of any license of ever owning a radio.
Well, that'll make you think.
And
twice.
That's been happening in the model aircraft community, where someone buys a drone and flies it near an airport, or flies it over a news scene.
Right.
And interfering with the news helicopters that are there.
Right.
Every now and then we read stories about some drone harassing a commercial airline at 30,000 feet and 600 miles an hour. And we're saying,
I don't know.
No.
That doesn't happen.
That's a military drone. There's nothing in the commercial world that can do that.
No, it would get sucked into an engine and blown out the back end.
All
people who are doing those remote control, radio-controlled airplanes, don't they have to have those within sight?
Line of sight, yeah. Line, so okay. Beyond line of sight is currently not allowed.
Okay.
But they're trying to get provision for that. So there's a big thing called FPV, first-person view.
Yes.
Where there's a camera in the aircraft and you're wearing goggles.
Okay, so you see through the camera whatever the plane is.
Right, so you cannot see the plane.
Right.
So you have to have a spotter who can see the plane.
Okay.
Currently.
But with those, not just DJI, but lots of other quadcopters, it's very common to run those in a situation where you may not be able to see it. You are literally doing that first-person view out of that.
Which is dangerous because you can't see what's around you.
Right.
You can't see what's around the airplane because you're only looking straight out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why that's against the rules is because it's not safe. And you're not supposed to fly over people,
right?
Because if there's a problem, you could crash on the... I remember in the Olympics a couple of years ago, one of the downhill race teams, a giant hexcopter, camera platform, almost hit a racer because something happened to it while it was following the racer down. So that, and that's the problem. When there's a problem, it could hurt someone.
Do damage,
especially the bigger, heavier camera platforms. Yep. See, so we're kind of hoping that we can get it to divide into people who want to fly an airplane and people who want to fly a camera.
Fixed wing versus...
fixed wing, rotary wing, multi-wing, that all doesn't matter. That's all considered a drone to the FAA.
And I know they've got a amateur versus commercial split.
Yeah, if you make money on your flight, then you need a Part 107 commercial license, which is a lot harder to get.
And more dollars.
But if you fly recreational, you don't... Mm-hmm. The licenses are a lot less.
Okay.
But yeah, it's separated in people that just want to fly their airplane versus people who want to fly a camera over crowds and news sites.
Different thing.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, tell you what, let's go back to the phones. We got Bob from Henrietta. Go ahead, Bob.
Let me take you off speaker here.
Okay. Excellent move. Thank you for that.
All right, that should be better. First off, a quick smart you know what comment.
We're familiar with those.
That's an idea. Shoot down the drones with the model rockets.
Yeah.
it's not a bug, it's a feature.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah, I think the moment you start adding tracking capabilities to some of your model rockets, people might have some concerns.
One of the semi-legitimate commercial concerns with drones are Amazon keeps talking about drone delivery, is that they're going to fly the package to you. Instead of drive it in a truck.
Yeah, neat story.
Neat story until as someone gets a net and knocks the drone out of the air as it's flying by their house. Ooh, free stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Or shoots it down.
Hijack it. Right.
Yeah. But we can't. Well, yeah, we can't even get autonomous cars to drive properly all the time. Well, you're going to get an autonomous flying vehicle to do it?
Doesn't legal theory state that you own the land you purchased in a wedge going down to the center of the earth and then a wedge extending up into space? So if that thing's hovering over my property, guess what? It's trouble.
Yeah.
If you're a real estate lawyer, please call us in and confirm that or educate us about what's either correct or not correct about that.
Depending on your jurisdiction, it's between 80 feet and 500 feet above the ground.
Okay.
And so most recreational aircraft is limited to below 400 feet.
Yeah.
And that's something else we're trying to change. Because 400 feet isn't that far.
I try to be really conservative with my, Black Friday made of Chinesium quadcopter.
Yeah.
I just run it around my front yard when nobody's under it and neither are any of the pets or anything like that. And I keep it within my property line and I'm hoping that that'll be okay. I know that I'm not that many miles away from the local airport, but I guess there's sort of like a funnel of restricted airspace around airports that up to a certain threshold is some radius and up to a different elevation threshold is a different radius. So a lot of stuff to keep track of there, but I'm just playing it real safe and just trying to get comfortable with the controls.
One serious concern people have is these things have cameras. You think I want something hovering over my property with a camera in it?
Yeah, I think if it's your own property, that's fine. If it's your device. But if you're flying over someone else's property, then I think you're
definitely overstepping.
But anyways, this isn't really why I called. The real reason I called was you guys were talking about radio. This is just an unrelated question, except it might help make your station easier. Hold a dipole antenna like you buy the cheap twin lead antenna, like a folded dipole type.
Mm-hmm.
Is that supposed? Does that work better if it's vertical or horizontal?
What do you think, Dave?
You're talking about a wire antenna?
Yeah, like a folded dipole antenna. I'm sure you've seen them.
Yeah.
They're clear plastic. They got two copper conductors
mm-hmm.
that connect to the twin dial lead.
It depends on your surroundings. I mean, when you're setting it up, if you're out in a field, and you've got some trees that you can go and, you know, do a T shape versus say, I got a lot of tree, you know, I don't have many trees around and I throw it up on a pole and I do what they call an inverted V. I mean, they'll both get out. The radio signals are still going to get out.
I'm not talking about getting out. I'm talking about reception.
That's the same thing. It'll still get out and also receive.
I found a website with a lot of math on it.
Yes, there's
math.
Yeah.
There's a lot of theory.
Again, it depends on your surrounding. You know, if you're trying to do this in a very noisy neighborhood, 10-1 odds the RF is going to squelch any noise. It depends on the band, the time of day. You can get a lot of interference.
What I'm specifically talking about is the FM broadcast band. I'm sure you see these antennas. They're already pre-cut to the proper resonant frequency.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm not able to determine is if this thing is more effective if it's aligned horizontally, like across the ceiling, or down the side of a wall.
I would say horizontally. Because you want the height. Height is always, on any antenna, the higher you get, the better off you are.
I'm seeing pictures of it both ways.
Mm-hmm. But, it depends on the situation. You know.
And what do they say about the radiation pattern on those? Do they have diagrams of those sort of things? So I'm thinking about things like Yagis that are very directional.
Yeah,
and
Yagis,
other stuff.
You want to they're forward pointing, and the lobes on that will
right.
go on.
And
out.
I wonder how the dipoles...
Well, if I understand correctly, they are directional also,
okay.
with the stronger directional face on to them as opposed to the direction they're pointing.
Right, oh. Yeah.
Okay.
Side, off the sides.
I haven't found anything clear that clearly states vertical or horizontal. Jen and Henrietta, I have a very hard time.
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
why I say just try it out. You got
try one of each.
Try configuration change. You know, yeah. Set it up one way, try it out. But again, it's going to depend on the time of day. If there's a storm coming through,
there's a lot of environmental impacts.
A lot of things that interfere now.
I can't eliminate all the variables.
Yeah.
I was just hoping you knew whether just by the nature of the beast, it's more effective horizontal.
It's just like yeah. computers. It all depends.
It sounds like it's time for some science. If you, I challenge you to try both and to call us back and let us know
yeah.
what kind of results you got. And then we can yep. see if anyone else wants to try it and duplicate your results. And then we can all learn.
It's not practical. The home entertainment center weighs over 300 pounds. I can't move that by myself.
Well, the antenna, not the center itself.
Yeah, but to get at where the antenna mounts to it.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely a challenge.
So here's a website that says there is no single right answer. It's like the debate of Ford versus Chevy.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
It could be.
Yeah, each way has its advantages.
Yeah. Again,
and it depends
it
on what's
be,
going between them.
All right, if you're going, say, vertical, if there's like some of the older homes, chicken wire in the walls.
Sure.
You know,
for plaster.
If it's horizontal, the antenna needs to be half a wavelength above the ground.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then you have to know what the wavelength of your reception is and
which is
divide that in
one,
half.
One over the frequency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's yeah.
play around with it and let us know.
But verticals can be mounted on roofs.
It's easy to go back to shooting drones with bottle rockets.
Yeah.
Well, you got to do something till bingo.
thanks,
yep.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Now, back to airplanes.
Okay.
In many of the airplanes, the antennas are... 90 degrees. You have two antennas.
Yeah,
they have 90 degrees to each other because you're working in a three-dimensional space.
Right.
You need to be able to get antennas in both directions.
Yeah. Well, works for Wi-Fi too.
Yep.
There you go. All right. That music tells me we got to take another short break. But hey, fear not. We will be back right after these few messages. Don't go too far. You're listening to Sound Bites on Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Sound Bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And welcome back to Sound Bites. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dennis Worcester.
And tell you what, let's go right back to the phones. Our bank is lit up, so let's talk to Steve in Greece first.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
I am going to be doing a presentation for some authors next month on Microsoft Word, how they can get much more out of it than they are doing right now.
Okay.
And I'm going to be using the Windows version.
All right.
Authors, a lot of times, a lot of people actually, use Macs and will have the Mac version of Word.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So my problem is, everything I've looked at, there's a lot of differences between the two versions.
That's true, yes.
Is there any, like, my presentation is going to be useless to Mac users if I can't come up with, figure out some way to compare the two, but I haven't been able to find a document or a website that does that for me.
Right. So there are a couple of ways that you could do this. One would be get a hold of a Mac or borrow one for a period of time and throw Word on it. Chances are good if you're subscribing to Word, you can install using one of your machine installs to put it on the native hardware. Secondarily, you can look for other references that exist related to Microsoft Word on the Mac. One of the best that I'm aware of, clearly there are dozens and dozens of people on YouTube who make all sorts of videos related to Microsoft Word on many different platforms.
I just found one on the How to Geek website.
Okay. And third, there are professional training companies who make videos online all about how to make use of many different types of computer applications, including Microsoft Word. And if you have, it sounds like you've put together an entire syllabus that's targeted specifically to writers and that you have specific things that you want to make sure to cover.
Yep.
So it sounds like you have a good set of targets that if you knew how to describe these to the Mac folks as well, that you'd be covered.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. So what I could recommend then is there's a company named LinkedIn Learning, and they used to be called lynda.com. And they are famous for having videos, generally very short videos, that describe different features of computer applications like Microsoft Word. Chances are good, even with like a one-month subscription to their service, you could go in with your list of important to authors features and find the video related to that feature for the Mac. Watch the video as many times as you'd like. And then take down the details that you need related to that, and then you'd have the other side covered for all of your Mac customers.
Excellent. Okay. I never found that in my research. That sounds like a wonderful source.
Yes. So LinkedIn Learning is a subscription-based tool, and they cover all sorts of things, generally related to business. And if for people who are employees or for people who want to increase the value of their resume, you can go through the entire series for a particular application and then obtain a certificate that says, hey, I took all these training videos related to Microsoft Word or Microsoft Excel or Final Cut Pro or any of the tools that exist in today's modern world. So it's a great resource. But again, I think you've got the advantages of having that targeted list. And at that point, it's just a seek and destroy mission about coming in, finding the specific things you need to know, and then getting out. I'm guessing you can get all that done in less than a month, and then you'll be into it dollar-wise just for that 1 month's services.
Well, if I can't do it in less than a month, I'm in trouble because the presentation's next month.
Okay. All right. Well, that's what I can recommend.
All right. Well, that sounds excellent. It sounds like a good source, and I will look at it.
All right. Give it a shot.
I'll come up with the answers. Thank you.
No problem. You know, it's wonderful when people call us and they know exactly what they need, but they're just not quite sure how to get it. And when people ask for things that we definitely know about, that makes life a lot easier for us, too.
Yeah, and I'm since I saw this How to Geek website, I had to turn off my ad blocker to see it, and then the page is just full of ads.
Oh, shocker!
So it's hard to see.
What?
But
on the internet,
most
ads?
Yeah, most of what I see with Word is pretty much the same between Mac and Windows.
I think a lot of it is, especially after the ribbon stuff,
yeah,
where they added the tabs ribbon at the top and then the ribbon. A lot of that is very, very similar.
In Microsoft Office itself, the Windows version can include Access, and the Mac version doesn't because they know they can't compete with FileMaker.
Microsoft Access is a database program that's been around for decades, and it was one that I'm not sure what wrangling was happening in the background with the companies, but it was something that Microsoft never released for the Mac.
Yep. All right, let's go back to the phones. We got Jerry from Webster. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yes, good afternoon. I was on a Zoom meeting the other day on my HP desktop, and I could hear and see the speaker, but on my end, I couldn't, my sound audio was off, and I couldn't get my camera to show my image on the page to work. I went into settings, and they say both the microphone and the camera are on.
Okay.
I don't know why it's not working then.
Well, what I can recommend, and Zoom does offer this as a feature, is they have the ability, when you are about to enter a call, to test your microphone and your speaker.
And when you're in a call, you can go into the settings and
make sure you're not muted.
Again.
Right.
Yeah.
So the test feature allows you to pick from all of the different inputs that your computer has related to sound and related to video. And it will ask you to make some noise on your microphone. And after a few seconds, it will attempt to play that noise back to you. So if you say testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, after a few seconds, you should hear that back into your headphones.
Were you using the Zoom app, or were you in a web browser?
I was in the Zoom app.
Okay.
Sure.
There's sometimes problems when you're using Zoom in a web browser.
Right.
Is that you have to tell the web browser it's okay for Zoom to access the camera and mic.
Right. Yeah, that can be tricky. But if you're using the application itself, the best thing I can tell you is even when you're not in a call, you can go to the settings for Zoom, and you can look at the video and the audio settings and do a quick test while you have your microphone nearby and your camera on. Sometimes on HP equipment for the camera, there's a little shutter in front of the camera.
A physical shutter that people
close for privacy. It's important. I've seen and helped folks with different models of PC laptop, and remembering to open that shutter is something that is easy to forget. So that can be something to check out as well.
Well, I did use that test while I was on the Zoom meeting for the audio, and it did play a little sound like it was working.
Okay, that's good.
But as far as getting the camera to work for my image, I couldn't. When I went into settings, I had everything on except this one thing called Desktop App Web Viewer. I don't know if and that was off. Would that make a difference?
I don't think so. That doesn't strike me as something that would restrict other people's ability to see you.
There is a I posted a link to Zoom's testing your video, and they have a test meeting that you can create.
Yes, right.
So if you don't have anyone you can do a test meeting with, they have a test meeting you can do to see if your camera and
like a dry run type of thing.
Yeah. Right. The other thing we sometimes see is that the camera and microphone can only be used in one program at a time.
Yeah.
So if you opened the camera in another program,
like then, Microsoft Teams or Skype,
then Zoom can't get it. It's usually the other way around. Zoom grabs it and doesn't let go, so you can't open it in another program after you opened it in Zoom. And usually restarting the computer fixes that.
Is this a built-in camera on your computer, or is this a external camera that you've got plugged in?
No, it's built in.
Okay.
And it's been able to work in the past. I haven't used it in a while.
Okay.
But I had the Zoom meeting coming up, and I thought I'd try it on the desktop, and it didn't seem to come through. So I'll have to try and test that Zoom.
Often on the keyboard, in the bottom left corner, there'll be a key that's labeled with the letters F and N, that is short for function, But when things aren't working, you can call it the F and key, and we won't hold that against you. No. And that's usually, I think, on HPs and Dells, it might be in blue. And there are also, across the top edge, a set of keys that have little blue pictures on them. It might be that there is one of those that is for your microphone that might be turned off. It might have a microphone with an X next to it. So it may be that the microphone itself on the computer is not powered on. And it could be the same for the camera. That's something to check out as a possibility.
Well, the confusing thing is that the settings indicated that both the camera and the microphone were on, currently okay. working. But I just couldn't come to conclusion.
All right. Well, part of the Zoom video setting test is to show you the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Show you what it sees.
Sound.
Showing you what the camera sees. And so doing that Zoom test meeting might help.
That's right, in the Zoom app, I can do that?
No, it's on the Zoom website.
Oh, website, okay.
They create a sample meeting from their end.
They call you.
And you you join it, and then it walks you through making sure your camera and microphone are working.
Yeah.
And that end can see you as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I've posted that link on our website.
Okay.
Soundbites.org.
I'll try that then. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yep. Sure.
I suppose it could also be permission. We didn't ask what version of Windows he had, but Windows 10 and especially 11, you may have to give permission to the Zoom app to see the camera.
Right, yeah. There's lots of... Everybody wants to be very secure and have very good privacy, so they don't want to just be able to randomly fire up the camera. But it's an important thing to know what might be in the way of the camera's image getting to the other end.
Yep. All right, let's go back to the phones. We got Walter from Greece. Go ahead, Walter.
Good afternoon to all.
Hello.
Question for you, or maybe you can give me some ideas of what to look. I have a desktop computer running MX Linux 19.3. As it sits here idling when nobody's using, the computer is quite silent.
Okay.
And it's on the login screen for all the different users to log into their, into their accounts.
Got it.
2 o'clock this morning, I wake up and the computer the fan is running at maximum. I mean, it is really whining. And it did it a couple days ago, earlier too.
Okay.
And so I'm wondering just what you might think is going on with it, because it's not being in use.
Okay.
It's turned off. I've run, by the way, RK Hunter, found a potential rootkit, XORDDOS, and looking at the file, it says number 402. But beyond that, I think I can get rid of that file without a problem. What else do you suggest they look?
Well, rootkit is one of the first things that could potentially be taxing your CPU and or letting others make use of your computer for
that
their
holds
purposes.
Everything else at hostage.
Yeah.
I would check your...
So once you've got those cleaned out,
Check your activity monitor or top in Unix to see if there's some process that launched and is running the CPU up. It may be a background backup task or a download updates task.
And I'm looking at Steve. Do modern Linux machines still do those daily, weekly, monthly scripts?
Yeah,
as utility scripts to clean out the system and keep it running properly. I know those used to run at 2 in the morning or whatever it was.
And if maybe your hard drive is getting ready to die, it's harder and harder to for the computer to do those cleaning files, and
right.
So it's got to ramp the fan up to keep the CPU from overheating.
Okay.
Those are the typical things. Yeah, fast fans means that there's a lot of heat somewhere.
Right.
And a lot of heat generally means the CPU's been busy.
Yep.
And it's just a matter of figuring out what kinds of things might be asking a lot of the CPU at that particular time of day or time of night, as it were.
Okay. Does it come to you over your mind just what command I put in order to see what the activity is, so I can just, if I see it again, go in and just put in
Well, in straight Unix, it's top.
Yeah, top-o space CPU, I think.
Okay.
Dash O means put it in order, and then CPU generally means show me.
There's a graphical activity monitor called SysMon, S-Y-S-M-O-N.
So one thing to thinking out loud, we need to find out, is this something that happens in the background that a user needs to not be logged in and you need to be at the user selection space, or will it still happen even if a user is logged in?
Okay.
That's something we need to figure out.
Okay, yeah, because as I say right now, there's no user is logged in at all
right.
at the time. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'll use those hints. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. It can be tricky to figure those things out. We have seen utilities, antivirus scans that run periodically. You know, a lot of things that normally would take up a lot of CPU time. The computer and the folks that write the software don't want that to run during the day because that's when a user is sitting in front of it. You don't want to make the machine really sluggish.
Have it happen at night to the updates and everything else.
Yeah, if you're the kind of person that keeps your computer on 24/7, a lot of those systems are designed to run at night. So it might be an antivirus scan, might be a backup, checking over your drive to see what files changed.
Program updates.
Yes, OS updates, computer updates, firmware. Potentially downloading and staging itself. There could be a lot of different things. In fact, now that I say it out loud, those updates that come through are generally encrypted, and they're checking against the they run the entire update through an algorithm to make sure that it hasn't been changed since it was downloaded.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in a situation where you've got a potential rootkit installed, I think all bets are off at that point.
Yeah.
It could be literally anything. So this means somebody else has literal control over your machine.
You may have to move the hard drive to a different computer to erase it because you can't really trust that computer.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of rootkits can survive a power out.
We used to have to, just on the Windows PCs, take the hard drive out, put it as a second drive in our test machine, because then that way rootkits start right at the minute you turn that power on. They're loaded before anything else. And that's why they're hard to get rid of, and they take full control. And no matter what you try to do, you're not going to get rid of them because it has, essentially all the admin rights and everything else of what gets started and what doesn't.
Yeah, before any antivirus and anti-anything actually runs.
Yeah, and can detect it. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, no, it makes a gigantic challenge.
Mm.
But, yeah, so the moment the caller says rootkit, it's kind of, all bets are off. You don't really have a lot of
success. And if he doesn't have another computer to do it, then the best thing to do then, since it is Linux, is back things up and then just wipe it and start fresh.
Yeah, if you can.
Yeah,
take off. And then restore your data from a backup.
Nuke it from orbit. That's the only way to be sure.
Only way to be sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's the safest. I mean, Unix is so easy to install and set up, and that, basically. And matter of fact, there was one program Nick told me about that you can run.
Okay.
That'll track, you can put in different programs that you want it to load and install after you do an initial install.
Okay.
And you can run that program, and it'll go out and get those programs and reinstall them for you.
Interesting. I know on Windows we've used things like Nynite and Chocolatey for things like that. And on the Mac, we've used Homebrew and AutoPackage to go and fetch things after the fact. Saves you from having to visit all the different websites and jump through the hoops.
Yeah, and you can just create a, because especially if you're going to do, set them up all the same, over a network for working that. Sorry, I'm losing my voice here.
Okay. Yeah, there are tools in the Microsoft world that make setting up many machines identically very effective and easy to do.
I see one called Yum.
Yes.
That allows you to install multiple packages with one command.
Yep, that's a very common Linux tool for, it's a package manager that finds, I think it's Yum, it stands for Yum Update Manager or something like that. It's a recursive acronym. So it's there are lots of tools that will go out, and if you know the names of the things you want installed, you can even build a little file that has one item on each line and point that, let Yum take that in as input, and it will go and execute and find each of those. Yeah. I know that's what I'm doing with Homebrew on my machine. So when I get a new machine, I bring my file over. I'd say, Homebrew, install yourself. And then, Homebrew, go take a look at this and go grab each of these lines. And I've got, you know, 30, 35 items. And it just
goes sets it up automatically.
Yeah, and I go get a beverage and let it do its thing. And I come back and it says, okay, I'm all done. Good to go. And I say, excellent.
Mm-hmm. Makes life a lot easier.
Sure, yeah. If I can fold laundry or empty the dishwasher while it's busy doing that stuff, and I don't have to watch progress bars move from left to right on the screen.
Yeah, and then hit, an exit button to now move on to the next one.
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing they never told me in college is how much of my professional life I'd spend watching progress bars.
Yeah, go and from then left hit to right. The enter key so you can go on to the next one.
Right. And what I've learned now after a couple of decades is that I can accurately predict just based on how fast the progress thermometer bar is going across. Oh, yeah, no, that's going to be done in about 2.5 to 3 minutes. Okay, that one's going to be closer to 10 minutes. Oh, this is like looking like about half an hour.
We always joke about how the estimated time lies.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Especially, no, I never look at that.
Especially when it says less than a minute remaining.
Uh-huh.
That's half an hour.
Yes.
Yeah. Or it jump, you know, it'll start at 38 minutes and jumps down to 5 minutes.
And then jumps up to an hour and a half.
Up. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I've had that happen with I was reinstalling an OS on a brand new M2 laptop this week, and we were pulling it in across the network because the place I work just doesn't have a local cache for these things. Apparently, I need to go build another USB-C install disk for this.
They update so fast, it's annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. There's an app for the Mac called Myst, which is hilarious to me because one of the other languages that I've been trying to learn how to speak for decades is German, and Mist means poop in German. So
with a Y or an I?
With an I. And it allows you to go download the installers directly from Apple so that you don't have to jump through all the hoops of going to all the different pages to fetch the right one.
I use one from Mr. Macintosh.
Oh. It
lists all of the installers. But then you get a warning, gatekeeper bypass warning.
Sure.
Even though he's downloading them directly from the Apple CDN,
yeah,
they didn't come from the App Store
right
first, and so you get a warning.
So then I try and build the USB installers. But
yep.
You're right. The moment you get it built, a couple of weeks later, a fresh update comes out, or that particular machine has a build
yeah.
that is unique to that machine, and there isn't a unified release yet.
And you can only create a build on a machine that's capable of that build. So I've got a Mac that's yes. limited to 10/15, so I can't make a 13 installer because it's too new.
Right. It's a whole bunch of challenges
yeah.
that way. Makes life interesting, keeps us on our toes.
At least with Windows, it's only 10 or 11.
It's true. And then it goes and fetches all the independent pieces.
Yeah, because they stopped supporting all the older versions and removed all the older versions from distribution.
Right.
At least on the Apple world, you can still download pretty much everything back to 10.9, I think.
I think it's more like the iOS model where they really want as many people as possible to be on the latest possible
yeah.
OS because it makes a nice, hearty, big environment for developers to code against and to build software for.
Yep.
And I think that's one of the big challenges that that people have is trying to keep up to date
yeah.
with that.
So, yeah, Apple goes back to 10.7 if you really need a 10.7, which was the first online installer.
Yeah.
It originally came on a USB stick with a MacBook Air.
Yes.
Which was the first computer to not have a CD drive, which is how your installer disks used to come.
Right. Oh, speaking
of that, yeah.
That's still one of my holy grails that I want to find. So if anybody has one of those USB drives, hey, let's talk. That's a collector's item that I'm trying to add to my collection.
Oh, there you go. All right. That music tells me, yep. And the conclusion of another edition of Sound Bites is coming to an end. But hey, don't worry. We'll be back again next Saturday for 166 hours with with more of your questions and answers. And if you got different topics, by all means, save them up and give us a call next week at noon, and we will take your questions. Thank you again, Dennis, for stepping in while Nick is not here. We really appreciate that, my friend. And we will see you folks next Saturday at Jazz 90.1 Soundbites.